Welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and creative entrepreneur, bringing you interviews, inspiration, and information on writing, publishing options, and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free author blueprint, and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode number 304 of the podcast. And it is the 14th of January, 2017, as I record this. So today I have an interview with Christine Catherine Rush. And those of you who listen to the show regularly know that Chris is one of my mentors through her books and blog posts and has been for a number of years now. And I've just been learning from her virtually. So often if I use the word mentor, it doesn't mean like, you know, they say at work, you should have a mentor who looks after you and stuff. What I mean is reading people's books, listening to their interviews, reading their blog. So I've been kind of, it's almost like stalking in a way, in a good way. But yes, I have been learning virtually from Chris. And then in October 2016, I attended the Coast Business Masterclass in Oregon, on the Oregon coast, and met her and her husband, Dean Wesley Smith, who as a couple are also sort of mentors to me, a sort of model of a happy, child-free, creative partnership. They sort of represent a model for me personally. And the week with them and sit down with Chris about my next sort of steps with the company completely changed what I was thinking about doing. And I wrote my 10-year business plan off the back of that week. So I really, you know, feel that Chris is someone who's changed my life a lot and has helped me learn a lot and make money and save money. And so basically I'm a complete fangirl, and I'm setting this up because in the first few minutes of the interview, I'm just all over the place. So you will notice that. But once I settle down, we get into dealing with self-doubt, how writing fiction is different to writing non-fiction, the importance of understanding intellectual property rights. And we talk a little bit about Chris's new non-fiction book, Closing the Deal on Your Terms, Agents, Contracts and Other Considerations, which you absolutely must read if you want to be a successful author for the long term, because you will be doing contracts, whether that's with cover designers or editors or publishers or people who want to license your rights. Very important that you know this stuff. Okay, so that is coming up. But again, there might be a slightly epic intro, but many of you have said you enjoy it, so I'm just going to carry on. A comment from last week, lots of excited new users of Vellum have contacted me and said they think it's amazing, but also disappointed Windows users. And some commenters on Twitter and on the blog comments suggested Mac in Cloud, which is exactly as it says, Mac in the cloud, so you can use it from a PC. So a cloud-based solution for hosting Mac applications. And this is not endorsed by the guys at Vellum, as they haven't tested the product for it, but it might be worth a try. And of course, you can try Vellum for free. You only have to pay when you actually export the files. So it might be worth a try. See if that works. Okay, publishing news this week. What probably the most interesting thing, I mean, next week should be more interesting because Digital Book World is on and there should be lots of interesting stuff coming out of that. But Overdrive reports library borrowing of ebooks are up 16% and audiobook borrowing is up 34% in 2016. So that's really interesting, especially as Rakuten, the company that owns Kobo, owns Overdrive. And fingers crossed, we will be able to get better distribution into these channels in 2017. So that is really interesting. The other thing is that Amazon released a WordPress plugin for easier affiliate links into Amazon Associates, called the Amazon Associates Link Builder, which if you have a WordPress site, you can just search for in the plugins area. And that is for, I haven't actually tried it because I do use a lot of Amazon affiliate links, but I just use the sort of, there's a toolbar and it gives you an easy link. But this is interesting because they're clearly trying to encourage people to use product links in a much more easy way. So yeah, I thought that was interesting. Then talking about the futurist stuff, which you know I like, I actually wanted to sort of take you back a bit because this week was the 10th anniversary of the launch of the iPhone, which is kind of mental because I remember when the iPhone came out and I remember going to my husband, oh, I don't need one of those. I ridiculed it. I was like, I don't need one of those. My phone is fine. I had one of those, you know, just old phones that texted and did phone calls. And I don't even like phone calls. So I was just texting and I was thinking, well, why would I pay so much for something I just text on? And I can't remember when I actually relented, like when I actually bought my first iPhone, but I still have one here next to me. And I run so much of my business from my iPhone that it's amazing. It's also my camera. It's my primary camera now. The last thing this device is a phone. You know, I read the news on it. I surf the internet. I read. It's just crazy. So I want you to think about if you're someone who has a smartphone of any kind, it doesn't have to be an iPhone, but if you have a smartphone that connects to the internet, that's the biggest shift really, is that people now have the internet in their pocket, which we didn't have 10 years ago, which is kind of crazy. So I want you to consider how initial resistance or even ridicule about a technology can change as it becomes more useful. And as things like the App Store came along and music of them, I mean, the iPhone is definitely responsible and the smartphone obviously going further for the rise of podcasting, you know, and audio has just gone nuts. Audiobooks are definitely bigger because of digital devices like the phones where you can get streaming audio. And I think the same thing will happen with the Amazon Echo or the Google Home devices and also with virtual reality. So first of all, on the Echo, if you look at the skills that are available, so and if I'm talking weird language, you will catch up with this stuff, I promise you, because I just think this is crazy. The skills that the Echo can do, and it's like, it's almost like an app store for the Echo. And at CES, the massive American electronics show, which is where they showcase kind of the technologies that are coming in the next year or two, the Echo is now inside a ton of different devices, and it will make it kind of ubiquitous, useful AI, and also Google Home. I haven't seen a Google Home. I don't even think it's in the UK, but similar type of thing. But the Echo, I think they're very smart, is sort of an AI, I don't even know what you would call it, an AI that goes into other things. And these skills are applications that you can use with it. So I just see that as technology that I ridiculed before Christmas and made my husband unplug and put in a drawer. And then I was like, nah, take it out again. And now I love it and I totally get it. But I was remembering with the iPhone exactly that happening, just me ridiculing the technology. And I think I'm actually someone who does pick up on technology reasonably soon. I'm certainly not the earliest adopter, but I'm maybe in the first or second wave. I also listened to, and coming back to VR, I think VR is exactly the same. I listened to an episode of the Digital Entrepreneur podcast this week on how virtual reality may shape the future of digital commerce with Brian Clark and Jared Morris. Jared's coming on the show in the next couple of weeks. Months. I've scheduled a way out because I'm away in February. But basically, that podcast is awesome. And I wrote a blog post for the Future Book a couple of years ago now on the future of VR in the bookstore space and was basically ridiculed for it. But this podcast actually started talking about the things that I was writing about then. So I'm pretty happy with the way things are heading. And if you're drinking the same Kool-Aid as me, or if you want to drink my Kool-Aid, check it out. The links are in the show notes, or it is the Digital Entrepreneur podcast episode on virtual reality. Okay, so really big personal news this week. I am ready to basically, well, I've put our Small Press website live. So my Small Press imprint is Curl Up Press, as in curl up with a good book. And you can find that at curluppress.com. And you'll see our lovely cat-loving logo and just a few links there. You'll also see a picture of Jonathan, who has emerged from behind the curtain as director of IP, Intellectual Property Rights. So you can go check that out. No, we're not taking submissions unless you have a massive estate that you want to hand over. But basically, no, we're starting this year with obviously my books, and Jonathan will be trying to start to look at licensing more of my rights. And as time goes on, things will change, but this is the first step. So that launch of Curl Up Press was basically timed with the arrival of my print books on Ingram Spark. So just before Christmas, I started getting most of my books onto Ingram Spark, all my fiction, except the short stories. And also most of my nonfiction is now through Ingram Spark, as well as CreateSpace. And the model of, as the Alliance of Independent Authors has been recommending for years, CreateSpace for Amazon only, and then Ingram Spark for extended distribution. So not selecting extended distribution. So I basically have spent, over a month now doing this. And it's been pretty considerable, because as I was working with my wonderful print book formatter and designer, Jane, we went through all the books and we updated the back matter in all the print books, and I fixed a few things, and then we got all the versions done, and then we uploaded them all, and then we ordered all the print copies to just check them, and then I put them live. And just so basically the whole thing has taken a while. And yes, I have ISBNs. So essentially the penny has dropped for me on why you would do Ingram Spark, because this week we went to the factory up in Milton Keynes in the UK, and obviously there's one in America, and there's these factories all over the world, these print-on-demand factories. But Ingram is a huge, global company. But this factory in Milton Keynes was fascinating. At one point I stood next to the cover printing machine, and each cover was kind of coming through, and it was so fascinating to see every single cover was different. And this represented to me the long tail of the print publishing industry, of what people want to consume. As in, these people are going into bookstores potentially and they can't find the book they want. So then they go online and they're finding a book on a most obscure topic, and then they're ordering it. And these books don't have to be warehoused. They don't have to be, they don't have to be published traditionally. Some of them were quite interesting, in terms of the topics that were coming through. But what it means, and I guess for me, it really just made me see that we are in that long tail of the publishing industry now. Maybe the blockbuster era is over. But for us anyway, we are, we're unlikely to have blockbusters as indies. What we have is this sustainable long-term income. And Jonathan and I were talking about it, and basically we were saying what we want to set up is every single book we write should have a sustainable sales model where literally we just set it up and it can sell like this forever. As long as these companies are still running, it's just an expansion. So how can you make it so you don't have to keep dealing with all of this stuff? If you do print runs, you have to get another run done if you run out of books and all this. Now, there are pros and cons of everything, and I'll come back to that in a minute, but it was so interesting to me how that worked. And the other thing is that just being on Ingram Spark as being on Kindle or being on Kobo or being on iBooks will not sell books for you. You still have to drive your own traffic. And thinking about that from the Ingram point of view has made me consider offline marketing. So for example, actually contacting libraries. My biggest seller for nonfiction is How to Make a Living with Your Writing. It's something that is attractive to a lot of people. So I'm thinking of doing even like a postcard campaign to libraries to see if they're interested in in buying that, ordering that. And the other exciting thing is the books went live on the 3rd of January. It's now the 14th of January, and I've already sold 76 books through Ingram Spark and made over $200. And that is more than I would usually, or some of those books, it's more than I would sell on CreateSpace. So I'm very interested to see how this is going to shake up. And as ever, I will share how things go, but I wanted to let you know about Curl Up Press and also about how awesome Ingram Spark looks to be. And it's positive already. I mean, it's not 100% easy to use, but I think it's going to be worth it. I mean, a lot of these sites are not massively easy to use, so you have to decide what your business model is. I do have a mega post on from indie author to small press coming, and I'll be writing all of this up in a really big post. It's turning into something pretty mega, so that's why I haven't put it out yet. The other thing is I also had a conversation about the premium print notebook with Clays in the UK, because this type of product, this kind of premium, particularly a lie flat notebook like a Moleskine, is actually impossible through print on demand. I will have to do a print run unless I do a book that's not lie flat, and very interested to see how we're going to do this. Thanks to Guy Windsor in particular, who sent me a ton of information on journals, and also to everyone who's done the questionnaire at thecreativepen.com/journal. So I am finding this an interesting challenge. And it will go along with this kind of small press idea. I'll have everything in print on demand, but then this one product I'm going to see. It may be that I just do one run and that's it. It's like a totally limited edition. It's, you know, going to be designed and made in the UK, and, you know, probably limited edition to those who pre-order because it's going to be difficult to do otherwise. So very interesting to start looking at things that small presses do, and also more into merchandise, which of course we talked about before Christmas in the interview with Melissa Addy. And next week, I'm going to have a much more detailed talk on journals too, and print products. Okay, so yes, that's interesting. I also went to see my new audiobook narrator, Caroline, who has quite a similar voice to me. So I'm really pleased that she's doing the narration. It's taken a load of work off of me for narrating it, and I'm very happy with what she's doing. So I'm going to try and get all my books into audiobook with her. Okay, so thanks for all your tweets and emails. Here's just a selection. Thanks to Salvador Doma, who sent me pictures of the hanging graveyards in the Philippines, which I had never heard of. So I was really pleased about that. I love hearing about these places that do things a bit differently. So I really appreciated that. And also to David C. Eads, who sent me some pictures of the historic Congressional Cemetery, which was interesting too. Thanks also to Daisy Lythe, who sent a picture of her beautiful cat, who apparently woke up during the last show and is looking unimpressed, but is absolutely gorgeous. And thanks also to Liv Campbell, who said, kudos to the Creative Pen on being a top writer's resource in Writer's Digest 2017 yearbook, and sent me a screen print of the book. So thanks, Liv. I didn't even know I was in it. So thank you for sending that to me. It's funny, isn't it, how you just kind of, if you're not monitoring these things, you don't even hear about them. So that is cool. Katie Coffran says, listening to the latest podcast, and it really does sound like you're on rocket fuel. I love it. Yeah, it's so funny. I've cut out sugar and dairy in the last couple of weeks, and I'm feeling so much more energetic. It's amazing. I'm not recommending it, obviously. This is not a health show, but once I do have some results, I will let you know. But I'm just feeling so much more energetic. So really happy with that and getting so much done. But then I also love January, so who knows? Alex Laybourne says, currently listening to the Creative Pen podcast with this little guy, and sent me a cute picture of his baby son. Simon Goodson said, loved hearing your bright voice and geeking out on vellum while trudging through the dark rain and mud. It actually snowed this week in Bath. Yesterday morning, we woke up and there was snow over the rooftops and it was very beautiful for about an hour before it all disappeared. Yes, Scott Williams says, listen to Brad Andelman on the Creative Pen podcast. When Vellum for Print is launched, I'm going to name my next kid Brad. Lots of people looking forward to Vellum for Print. I think that'll be really interesting. And finally, MB Manthi, says, for your podcast, you must have recorded new versions of the intro and outro, right? Not a huge change, but I like them. So congratulations, MB, for noticing that I did indeed record new versions of the intro and outro, because the wonderful Dan, who is now the podcast tech guy, said I needed to do new ones because they were a bit naff. So he, well, technically a bit naff. So he has fixed them up. So we are a bright and shiny show for 2017. Okay, so today's episode is sponsored by everyone supporting the show on Patreon, because I'm just so pleased, and you know I get a bit teary when I talk about the Patreon support, because I've did an interview yesterday with Tara Gentili, who will be coming on the show in the next few weeks. And she talked about her podcast being part of her body of work. And that really resonated with me, because this is a massive part of my body of work. And if, you know, sometimes we equate things like podcasting as separate to things like books, but this is an intellectual property asset. This is something that changes lives. This is something that is part of what I do with my time. So I love getting the Patreon support, because it's the same as you guys buying my books or people buying my books. It feels like, you know, a payment for something creative that I do. And that is so precious. And I'm so appreciative of everyone who supports the show on Patreon. And thanks to all the super old patrons who've been supporting the show for over a year now. And also thanks to new patrons, Zach Bohannon, Salvador Doma, Serena Clark, Colby R. Rice, Jamie Ferguson, Warren Bloom, AKR Scott, Kaki McClendon, Zara Keane, Sally Stevenson, and Melanie Levy. Another bumper crop, which is amazing. So thank you so much for supporting the show, everybody. I really do appreciate it. If you would like to support the show with just a couple of dollars a month, you will get the extra monthly Q&A audio, which I will be recording in the next week. So submit your questions if you're a Patreon supporter. You can support the show at patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen. Let's get into the interview with Chris. Today, I'm here with Christine Catherine Rush. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Joanna.
It's great to have you on the show. Just a little introduction for anyone who doesn't know Chris. Chris is an internationally best-selling and multi-award-winning author of so many books in a lot of genres under several different pen names. It was way too much to mention. She's also an award-winning editor, and her weekly Business Rush blog posts are essential reading for indies who are serious about a writing career. And her latest non-fiction book, which I have here, is Closing the Deal on Your Terms, Agents, Contracts and Other Considerations. Now, there's so much to talk about, Chris, but I wanted to kind of wind the clock back. Did you always want to be a writer? And can you tell us a bit more about the path to your success, as you're such a role model to so many people?
Oh, no. Next thing you're going to do is tell me I'm legendary or something. No. Yes, I always wanted to be a writer. And I, from my earliest memory, and I actually think, honestly, it was just a bid for attention, because I am 20 years younger than my other siblings. I was a surprise. And one of my earliest memories is of sitting with, or, you know, everybody sitting in the living room of the house I grew up in, and me going from person to person to person, all of whom were adults, asking them to play with me. And they were all reading, and they said, no, we're reading. So I think I just decided that if I wanted them to pay attention to me, I had to write something so they could read it. I mean, it's pop psychology, but it's there. Good heavens, the path. I was just dogged. I think I mean, you can ask some more specific questions, but that was the ultimate path. Is I didn't do anything else. I didn't really try any. Everything was geared toward becoming a writer for my whole life.
So you, but I read that you did some journalism and radio. So you didn't just go, oh, when I'm going to write, I'm going to be a novelist, and that was it.
Well, no, because I had been raised to believe that fiction writers don't make any money. So I figured I had to, if I was going to make a living as a writer, I had to do it as a journalist and as a nonfiction writer. And then that tumbled me into radio because there were job openings in the town I was in for volunteers, and they would train you to be a radio person. And I went and volunteered and eventually ended up running the news department for actual money. You know, it worked out that I soon at some point learned that fiction writers made money. And then I said, no, I'd rather be a fiction writer than a nonfiction writer. And, you know, I'm encapsulating like decades there, but that's how it worked.
Yeah, no, I love that your path is so zigzag, and we'll get more into that. But one of the questions I always, you know, I was trying to figure out what questions to ask you, because there's so much I wanted to ask you. But one of the things that comes up over and over again for me is how you manage to be an award-winning fiction author and an award-winning editor, which to me seem so different. And many people struggle with this difference between the sort of creative mind and the editing mind. So how do you balance those two?
Story. It's all about story. And if the story isn't good and if it's not memorable, then it's just not worth my time. And I don't care if that's a story I'm writing or if it's a story that I'm reading. And, you know, I've always been very firm in my opinions and very confident in my opinions. So I started editing quite young because I believed that I actually knew what I was doing, even when I didn't. And so, you know, I went for story. I didn't care, you know, if the words were pretty. I didn't care if there were problems in the manuscript. If the story was good, we'd work on it and make it more worthwhile. And it seems to be, since I started reading at the age of 3, it seems to be something that's just really innate and down there for me, and in storytelling. And so by keeping a focus on story, which is what those two things have in common, then I was able to do both. Although I have to admit that toward the end of my years as the editor of FNSF, I realized I had to choose between being an editor and being a writer. They weren't 100% compatible, especially at that level, because everybody was seeing me as an editor and they never recognized my writing anymore. And so I was just getting bombarded with the whole editing side of things. And I realized that in order to become known for my writing, I had to give up editing, which was hard because I missed it once I did.
But you've recently done some other projects, haven't you, with editing? So you've kind of got back into it.
I did. I would kind of crept back into it with my blog. I started doing a recommended reading list, which is just like editing in some ways, because when you edit a magazine, what you put in a magazine is the stuff you like the best. You don't buy stuff you don't like. And so, you know, my recommended reading list was the stuff I liked the best out of what I read every month. And that was kind of creeping back in. And then Dean and I realized that my husband, Dean Wesley Smith, and I realized that, it was possible in the indie world to start up a magazine again and do it in the way that we wanted to do it. We tested it with a Kickstarter first, and we figured if we didn't get any money from the Kickstarter, we wouldn't do it. And that turned out to be Fiction River, and it's been really popular and really fun. And then I got a bug up my butt about, you know, people kept saying there's no women in science fiction, and they'd say it to me. And I'm like, what am I then if I'm not a woman who writes science fiction and has done so forever? It would drive me insane. And I would start saying to these women or these people, it's usually women, which I thought was even weirder, I'd say, have you read Andre Norton? Have you read C.J. Cherry? Have you read Lois McMaster Bujold? You know, and they would say, who? And I'm like, okay, there's a problem here. And then I started investigating where the problem was and realized that a lot of the women who wrote science fiction wrote in genres that were not, quote, literally acceptable. And the other writers, the historical writers, were not getting reprinted. So I put together an anthology, and I hope to do more of writers that I feel And I don't care if they're male or female. I feel that they should have been continued to be printed. And as I was going through doing that, I found a whole bunch of other writers, men, writers of color, that stopped being published because they weren't in the in crowd, or they didn't have that one story everybody thought of as the classic story. They had several classic stories, or you know, they had a great story for 1 year and then they went away. And I'd love to bring some of those back.
Yeah, which is amazing. And I was just reading your business blog from today. So
in which I mentioned you.
Yes, I know, it was lovely. But one of the things you said was, and I quote, I have hundreds of projects I want to do right now and no time to do them. And it's funny because you're talking about all the other things you want to bring back. And I know, of course, you write a ton of different series under all these different names, and you've got the magazine and you've got everything going on. So I know you've just written that. But this is one of the big problems, I think, is what project do people do when you get past the point of having no ideas, which I realize some people have that. Once you get past that, then you have the, I have so many ideas, I don't know what to do with them. So how do you, with so many ideas, juggle what you're actually going to work on?
I have learned over the years to trust my, what I called in the blog, my muse, but really it's my subconscious. And it's so whatever I'm the most interested in, I've learned to trust it. And it kind of surfaces about 3/4 of the way through whatever I'm working on. So if I'm working on something right now, if I'm nearly done, my little back of my head voice is going to go, you know, this is kind of interesting and you should read that. Or I miss writing this. And if I pay attention to that voice, because it's really hesitant and quiet, that's the project to do next, because that's the one I'm going to be excited about. The ones that come at me from my front brain, my critical brain, that say, you know, the fans have been waiting for this particular project, or I've been getting a ton of letters on this particular project. I know midway through, I'm just going to grind down and I'm not going to be interested at all. And it won't have that spark of life that I think is really important to storytelling. And that's how I choose it. Yeah, okay, I say that. It took a lot of years to become that writer and to realize that the quiet voice is the one to listen to, not the, you must write this because people want it voice, much louder, much more powerful voice.
Yeah. And I wonder there then, because you know, I discovered you and Dean through your nonfiction blogs and your nonfiction books, and then subsequently have started reading your fiction. And this is, you know, those of us who are kind of in this sharing what we do while we're doing it space. Yeah. I know that's how people find my fiction as well, through the nonfiction. Do you balance fiction and nonfiction in your, or do, again, does that come from the muse?
Well, no. I started as a journalist. And so nonfiction to me is something with a deadline. And it's something that I can, I hate to admit this, I can write it when I have a migraine. I can write it, you know, when I have the flu. I can write it when I'm not thinking very clearly. Occasionally there's like weird mistakes in it, but I can just do it because I had to. It was my day job. And it didn't matter if I used to put on a newscast at 7 o'clock at night. And it didn't matter if all my volunteers or all my news staff showed up. Didn't matter, because I had 30 minutes I had to fill every night, whether I felt good or whether I was short-staffed or whatever. And so I'm used to doing that. So having a weekly blog, I start planning it in my head, you know, days ahead of time, sometimes write it days ahead of time, and sometimes I stack them up. And that's easy because I know this deadline, I have to hit it. The fiction, on the other hand, that's something I have done for myself from, oh my goodness, my sister has a book I wrote when I was 7. And I'd love to get it back from her, and she's never going to give it to me. but you know, it's something I've done. I've told myself stories since I was a little girl. And that's just something I do naturally.
Mm. Yeah, because it's interesting. I was talking to someone about, why is fiction so tiring to write? Because it feels like when you spend some time writing fiction, it's very tiring. And I wondered what you thought about this, because I wondered if it's because we make so many decisions. Where, you know, nonfiction is kind of you're putting out of yourself, and the fiction is a kind of different decision-making process. Do you find that more tiring?
I do, but for a different reason. I think nonfiction is like a conversation like we're having right now. And so you can have a conversation when you're really tired, and you can just give that kind of information. It's factual. It has its basis. Sometimes when Dean and I give talks, we call it, you know, you put the quarter in and let the machine run, because some of them are just speeches you've given forever, and you can do it when you're asleep. But fiction, for me, if I'm writing fiction and I'm doing it well, I'm not thinking and making decisions. I'm actually living it. And so when you're living an adventure, which I would hope that your storytelling is, even if it's just somebody sitting in a room imagining things, it's an adventure of one kind or another. You have all that emotional reaction, and you have all of that other stuff going on. And so I think, you know, it's more akin to exercise or running a race or actually living a very difficult day of your life. And that's why it's tiring.
Mm. Oh, good. Well, it makes me feel better to hear you say it is also tiring, though, because, you know, sometimes you feel a bit weird when you're when you think, oh, I've just spent 2 hours writing and I'm really tired. But
oh, yeah. No, if I have there are some days, especially like when I'm writing the Chris Nelscott Smokey Dalton books, which are they're set in the late 1960s, early 1970s. They're set in a very difficult part of Chicago, the South Side. They're research intensive. And I like to say, and I think it's true, that Smokey, who's my African-American detective, has no sense of humor. Everybody else around him does, but Smokey doesn't. You can joke about things and he'll get mad at you. He's one of those people, which when you're in his head, because it's a first person book, most people don't even notice he has no sense of humor. But I, as the writer, notice. And those books, I don't get as much done on them because it's so heavy. Everything is very serious for this man, and it's life and death. And it really is life and death for him every day. And so those books tire me out much quicker than something like, I usually follow that with a Christine Grayson romance novel, which are funny and light. And they make me giggle, even if they're about serious topics. And I do that because after, you know, 3 months of walking around trying to, beating people up and trying to solve the world's problems, I need to do something goofy and weird and I can't believe where that came from kind of writing.
Yeah. And I love that you do all these different series. And in the past, you've used more names, I believe, than you have now, which I've read several views on it, that it's either a vestige of traditional publishing or now with different author brands. So I use two different names, JF Penn for my fiction and Joanna Penn for my nonfiction, which I like because it separates people on Amazon and the AI and the algorithms and all that know who they're targeting. What's your feeling on using different brand names at this point?
I look at it from a reader perspective because I'm a reader first. And I'm the reader that, have you ever heard of the writer Barbara Mertz?
No.
Nobody has, because she was a nonfiction writer. But they know Elizabeth Peters, the mystery writer, and they know Barbara Michaels, the gothic romantic suspense writer, both of whom are her. I'm one of those people who would go into a bookstore completely ignorant of the fact that Barbara Mertz was the person behind both of those and have that long conversation about the fact that I really like Barbara Michaels, but I really hate Elizabeth Peters. And so, you know, I like having that distinction. I'm also a very sensitive reader. So before I go to bed, if I read something about, you know, people being murdered and, you know, horrid things happening and true crime stuff and, you know, or a horror novel in which, you know, limbs are being ripped off and everything else, I don't sleep. So I'm reading romance or certain kinds of YA or, you know, light young children's fantasies before I go to bed. And if I tell this story a lot, but when I was driving home, my father was dying actually. So I was driving across country to go see him and I was reading Nora Roberts, Miss Romance Writer. Okay. It was an early Nora Roberts and I got to Denny's restaurant in somewhere in the Dakotas and I'm sitting there reading it and all of a sudden, and I'm sorry, folks, I can't remember the name of the book, but the baby dies. Middle of the book. And this baby who's been cute and lovely, he gets murdered in the middle of this book. And it's not what I needed at the time. And I'm a fairly passionate reader. And I threw it across the restaurant, nearly hit an old lady. and I almost off Nora Roberts. for a long time. I stopped reading her at night because I couldn't, it was my relaxation reading. So as a pen name thing, I would never have the same name for Christine Grayson as I would for Chris Nelscott. I just wouldn't, because of those readers, they would have to approach it really cautiously. Is this one of the funny books, or is this one of the books in which children die? And I really value that space of that protected space of the happy ever after ending and that sort of writing. Mm-hmm. Now, all that said, I would probably have a lot more stuff under Christine Catherine Rush than I did, because I got started in traditional publishing and I have three established names, pen names, and they're human being pen names in their own right. And if I abandoned them, or it would take more work to separate them out. But if I were starting today, I would put similar books in mood and tone under similar names. And it's mood and tone, not genre for me.
I think that's actually a really good distinction. And yeah, I'm glad I have mine under two, because they have very different voices. And, you know, talking about voice, you know, that's something I don't think I discovered until about book five, fiction book five. And when I was like thinking about everything you do and what I've read of yours over the years, it seems that your mission is kind of empowering authors, as your nonfiction side is kind of empowering authors with knowledge and knowledge and skills, I think. But why? And I think one of the biggest issues with authors is this self-doubt in both the writing voice, in the business and all of that. So why do you think authors in particular have an issue with self-doubt, and how can people deal with that?
Well, I think writers are a unique kind of creature. I don't know if other artists have the same thing, but it's kind of this incredible self-confidence and incredible self-doubt mixed up together, because we all believe that our voices are strong enough and important enough to be worldwide international bestsellers, and that our stuff is good enough to be out there. And once we publish something, everybody should bow at our feet. I don't care. At a certain point as a writer, you learn, once you become successful, not to say that, but every beginning writer says that, you know, when my book is published, it's going to be, you know, the world's going to fall at my feet. And then it doesn't happen and we get horribly disappointed. But at the same token, we are completely frightened of what we've done, and we lack confidence and everything else. Some of that comes from being an introvert. Some of that comes from, if you're a good writer, you're writing from the space where you live. You're writing your real self, and you're kind of afraid that you're going to get caught with your real self. I like to compare it to parents and children, because we all learn the critical voice, and your real self is that little two-year-old. If you've ever watched two-year-olds, they're running around and they're just insane. And they do all this stuff that you're just not allowed to do. I mean, I watched a two-year-old take off on a very hot day, take off all of his clothes and throw them down a sewer drain. And then he ran around screaming through a parking lot. His parents weren't very happy with him afterward. But you know, that's storytelling. Basically, you peel off all your clothes, you throw them down a sewer drain, you run around screaming in a parking lot. And then your parents come over to you and say, don't you ever do that again. And probably, you know how much money that cost and all of that stuff. Or you've seen little kids screaming, screeching in a restaurant, and the parent will take them outside and train them that you don't do that. Mm-hmm. So when you're writing out of that two-year-old, you're writing out of that screaming in a restaurant, and you're waiting for somebody to come to you and say, you know, that's just not allowed. And a lot of writers, especially the ones who are good students, the ones who are well-behaved human beings out in the real world, they have more problems with this than the rebels. The rebels learned somewhere along the way, I don't care. You can do whatever you want to me. I'm still going to write this. But the people who were straight A students, who, you know, graduated at the top of their class, they're going to have a heck of a problem with this.
Yeah, that's me. I always had the good girl problem, you know, still do really, you know, wanting to be a good girl and, you know, behave and everything, which is why I think I have problems with self-censorship. But, you know, that finding that little two-year-old, have you ever struggled with finding that two-year-old, or how do you access that when you've been a good girl all day with your business stuff and, you know, nonfiction?
Well, my 2-year-old's a lot closer to the surface than most people's. I was a good girl too, but I was a good girl as a mask because my home life growing up was not very good. And so in order to have a better life, I would go out into the real world and be, you know, this straight A student and do all this stuff so that my parents never paid attention to the fact that I was dating the guys that you really shouldn't be dating and going out and doing, stealing cars and doing all that kind of
playing
lovely
poker.
Stuff. I didn't play poker because I wasn't any good at it. But, you know, I was the one who was riding shotgun with a group of drunk guys. So who's the dumb person in the car? It was me. But, you know, so I had those two sides, and I have this, always have had this, what I call, forgive me for using this language, it's an off-kit gene. And I've had it since I was really, really young, which is my very first job midway through. I realized it, I thought at the age of 16, it was a highly stupid job. And midway through the first day, I said, I'm not doing this anymore. And I quit and walked out. And so I've always had that side of me of it's easier for me. And I think that's why it was easier for me to break all those rules, because I had those two sides. I can play the good girl on TV. I'm not the good girl. That's the problem. My friends kept trying to hire me to work in Hollywood because, you know, at the time I was much younger and I was very pretty, and that was a great way of getting your way into the work. And, you know, then they would say, you're really smart, you know, story, and you can do all this stuff. And I'm like, I'll last 6 months. And they'll, no, you won't. You'll be fine. And I'm like, no, you don't understand. 6 months in, somebody's going to come to me with a completely reasonable request. Like, hey, Chris, you're holding a pen. Could I have it, please? And I will jump down their throat and I will kill them because I've been a good girl for 6 months, and it suddenly, boom, snaps. And I can't deal with it anymore. Mm. So, you know I can't work in that confined environment. And I've watched people. I have really good friends who are the straight A students who live the perfect lives. They have a lot more trouble with this than I do.
Mm. Oh, no, that's really good to know. I really enjoy hearing these stories about the different sides of your life. Because I think, you know, especially those people who say only read your business books or your nonfiction books might think you're just very, very serious. But if you read some of your other books...
Yeah, no, I'm not very, very serious. I can get really goofy.
Yeah, and that's why, yeah, I want people to read some of your other books. But let's come back to this very serious book on closing the deal on your terms. Now, I keep telling people to read this book, and I wonder why people have an issue. Why are people so resistant? Why are authors so resistant to reading and empowering themselves with knowledge about intellectual property, copyright, contracts? Why do all these terms scare authors so much?
They're artists, and artists, we seem to have this idea in our culture that artists are delicate flowers who need to be taken care of. And somebody will come in and take care of you once you've become an artist, and they will, you know, make sure that your work gets properly presented to the world and all of that wonderful stuff. And it doesn't happen. They will take care of you. And they will take care of you and line their own pockets at the same time, which just is heartbreaking to me. But it happens over and over and over again. And really, right, I hear writers all the time say, I don't want to be bothered. I don't want to think about any of this other stuff. I'm a writer so that I don't have to learn this stuff. And what they don't understand is they're only going to be a writer for a couple of years if they don't learn this stuff. Hmm. It's harder to be a freelance artist, I don't care what art form you're in, than it is to have a day job and to do all of that basic good girl stuff that we were talking about. It's a lot harder because you don't have a set path. You're on your own. You have to figure this stuff out yourself. And then you have to take responsibility for what you're doing. And that's why you find the book empowering, because you're one of those people who does do that. A lot of people find this whole thing scary.
Mm.
And I understand that.
Yeah. And again, it's such a great book, and I'm rereading it. My husband's reading it because I say to people, like, you know, this type of information can save you a lot of money and also make you a lot of money if we just get down to money. But one of the things I think people still don't get is the idea of intellectual property. And I know it's a kind of basic level, but I wonder if, and huge in a way, but can you explain why a book, when an author says, oh, I finished my one book, why that one book is not actually one thing?
It's many things. And learning copyright isn't really hard. In fact, I have a free blog. And the book that you're showing is also on my blog for free. And if nothing else, go read the post called Knowing Your Rights or whatever it is, something along those lines. It's under the business tab, and it is one of the posts in there, and it has the word rights in it. And it's free, and it just explains copyright in a real quick way. And that'll help people understand, because what I'm going to talk about right now is that your copyright, Dean calls it a magic bakery, and that the pie just keeps renewing, which my brain kind of has trouble with. I think of it more like when you write a book, you can sell what are called derivative rights. So that's what movie rights are and gaming rights and all of this. You license them, actually. You don't even sell them. If you sell them, you're making a mistake. So I think of it more like real estate. When you finish a book, you have built a house. And so that house, you can rent the house. You can rent rooms in the house. Eventually that house, if you want to use the word magic, can grow into a hotel. And you can have people in various rooms in the hotel. It can grow. That one piece of property can become an entire subdivision if you're creative enough. Let me give you an example. Ian Fleming was a very gregarious man. And when he was doing the whole James Bond thing, he would license the rights to Bond or to a particular book on napkins in a bar. So when Albert Covey Broccoli decided that he wanted to make movies based on the Bond books, he found out that Fleming had signed these napkins to a bunch of people, many of whom he could not remember. And so that is a legally binding contract. And, so what Broccoli and his cohorts did was invite them all to a major hotel in London. I think it was the Savoy, but I'm not sure. And he rented the entire hotel. He kept them separate from each other. And he went from room to room to room to room negotiating with these people to get the rights back so that he could make, I think it was, what was the first Bond movie? The Man with the Golden Arm?
Golden Gun. Dr. No.
Yeah, I think it was Dr. No. And so, you know, he negotiated all this stuff. There's a really neat book on this. So I'm working on some of this on my memory, and some of it may not be really accurate. But I remember the hotel and him going from room to room to room, trying to get little snippets of the rights together and figuring out what to do, because it was such an illustration of one property and one way of doing it. And it was a real life example. He was doing that. So if you learn how to leverage your copyright, then you can make a ton of money, even if your books aren't selling at Stephen King levels. You can do that. And the other thing that you can do when you leverage your copyright is it helps you as an artist, because as an artist, when you write something, it's your baby. But if you start thinking about the copyright on it, that's a thing. Mm-hmm. And so once you're done with the baby, then you can turn it into a thing and you can worry about selling the thing without touching the baby at all.
Mm, yeah, switching your creative mind into that kind of business head. And I think, you know, one particular question I wanted to ask about this copyright stuff and properties is the current trend for co-writing. And I've started doing this too, and Kindle Worlds. And I didn't even realize until I'd read your stuff that this could be a major deal. So someone asked me, could I write a book with one of my major characters in their world so that my character and their character are in the same book? Now, reading your stuff, I'm now like, no, I shouldn't do that, because that would somehow tie my character rights potentially with theirs as an entanglement in some way. What do you think of this co-writing trend?
Oh, you can do that, but you have to have, and here's the thing, you have to have a very firm legal agreement drawn up by an IP attorney. And it has to, you know, if you're worried about tying your character to that particular project, then that agreement has to state this does not do that. Mm-hmm. And it has to be in existence before you guys do the writing. And that's where the problem usually comes in. It's because people are not doing that ahead of time. And then the problems come up and then you're in court. Yuck.
Yeah. Well, it's, yeah. And I think this is why this book is so important. And, you know, again, I'm going to recommend it to people because I think people are so scared of making a contract. But me and my husband have made a contract, you know, between us for the things we do together. Me and my mom have a contract, me and my dad, for that, you know, for things that projects that we're doing together because of, you know, the potential downside, even though the potential upside is good. So I just want to encourage people not to be scared. That's probably the main thing, right?
Yeah, and the other neat thing about contracts, and this is the thing most people don't think about, is that it gives you clarity. If you're talking about it ahead of time, then you find out where these moments of problem could be. Mm. And you'll get to them before it becomes charged and before it becomes a certain issue. You'll find out that you don't necessarily agree on how you're going to market a book or, you know, what you're going to do with licensing that particular character versus this property and everything else. And you can solve it before it even exists. And then it's easy. And then when there's a problem, you can always go back to the document and say, nope, you agreed to this. And again, it becomes easy or easier. And that I think is, and it'll save your relationships. That's the really big thing. I mean, if you really value the relationship, then you want to have this in stone ahead of time.
Mm, which is great. And it's never too late either. So when I saw you in Oregon after your talk, I went, oh dear, I don't have a contract with the person who's writing a treatment and a screenplay based on my books. So I immediately went and sorted that out based on what you taught then. So I think it's so important for people to realize that you can still sort this stuff out later on as well, as long as things haven't gone bad.
Yeah, and you can even sort it out when things go bad once you calm down. Mm. But that's the harder place. Mm. I mean, there's always a solution, but it gets progressively harder the more emotions are involved in it. And that's the real problem. We're human beings. And so we're going to end up having an emotional response to the stuff that's going on around us. And better to do it ahead of time when it's an idea than when you're in the middle of the throes of the project.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so that's one thing that indies, I think, are doing wrong, which is not taking their rights seriously enough and not protecting things early enough. But you've been, you know, you've seen every side of publishing and you've, you know, been in publishing a long time. What do you think indie authors, like one or two things, obviously, that indie authors are doing wrong right now? Like, what would you like to fix with the indie community?
I think the indie community is great. And one of the things I absolutely love about the indie community is, unlike the traditional publishing only community, they are much more business minded. So a lot of the problems that indies have are less severe than the problems that traditionally published writers have. So I just need to put that out there. But one of the things I think indies need to do is they need to think long term. And they're not. They're thinking next week, or this subgenre is hot right now and I'm going to write it and, you know, I'm going to sell a million books on Amazon, not thinking that everybody's writing that subgenre and people are going to eventually stop reading it because they're not writing from their heart. So indies need to realize that if they're in this, they're in this for the long haul. And the long haul isn't 2 years from now. The long haul is 20, 30 years from now. And their planning needs to be based on that. And that's hard to do, especially as you're just starting out or you need money or you took that plunge and you dumped your day job and, you know, now you're trying to earn money every day. That's a hard position to be. And you have to balance that day to day with the long term view of, yeah, they're going to pay me $50,000 right now for this particular project to make it into a treatment of a movie. But A, that's not a lot of money when it comes to Hollywood. And B, they want to buy everything. So I lose that entire property. Yeah, I could use $50,000 right now. It would pay off this and it would pay off that and maybe pay off my student loans. But how am I going to feel when it becomes the Harry Potter of its generation and there are theme parks and there are all this other stuff and I'm not getting a dime? How am I going to feel about that? And, you know, that's where indies fall down. And a lot of indies would then say, and I've had them say to me in the middle of that kind of description, oh, that'll never happen to me. Mm. Guaranteed. The person it happens to is the person least prepared for it. Guaranteed. Because that's just the way karma works.
Oh, that's a shame because I'm preparing.
Well, you're going to be the exception to the rule.
Fantastic. No, and I think that I love the idea that things might take a while. I mean, it's really interesting right now. We've got and Stephen King stuff is kind of now The Dark Tower. We're seeing projects that were written in the 70s suddenly being made because technology is better, and also people are liking the darker stuff, like Netflix is doing a lot of darker stuff. So the time, it can take that long, right, to do these things.
And bandwagons, I mean, what didn't happen before was traditional publishing did not, and they still don't, know what their backlist is and what their back inventory is. And not, you know, the back inventory that they published 2 years ago, the back inventory they published 20 years ago. So if something becomes hot, like the dark stuff, like you mentioned, or the 80s, I mean, the 80s, after Stranger Things and everything else, have become really big, and disco stuff has become really big because of some of the stuff that Netflix is doing. So if you have, like, if you were writing in the 1970s and you have the ultimate disco novel, but you traditionally published it, it's never going to get reissued. But if you're an indie and you find out that this trend is going, you can just say, hey, this is, put a new cover on it, make it a little more modern, put it out there with some fresh advertising, and suddenly you have something that everybody's going to want. And the thing is, you can't predict this. I mean, Stranger Things, I listened to an interview with the Duffer Brothers, the guys who wrote it, and they took it to every single network before they took it to Netflix. And they said they were rejected 63 times, something like that, because everybody said the 80s are so passe, nobody cares. And this looks like you're taking bits and pieces of all of the 80s movies and, you know, putting it together, so we don't care. And that's what people love about it. You can't predict it. And so these things are going to come up, and you can't say, oh, well, 10 years from now, this is going to be the hot thing. You can have a guess by looking at what little kids are reading and what, you know, the little kids think are the best thing. You can absolutely have a guess, and it'll probably be correct from 15 to 20 years from now. Because if little kids like dark stuff, they did. They liked R.L. Stein. That was 20 years ago. And now dark stuff is back. But it's not R.L. Stein dark stuff. It's adult dark stuff and very different. You can kind of guess some of it, but you're still never going to hit it exactly.
Yeah. Oh, no, that's Stranger Things is awesome.
Isn't that great?
So good. Right. We are almost
speech for things. I just agree with cats on it. So there you go.
So we are almost out of time. And I have one more question for you, which is, you also write science fiction. So that's one of your many talents. And I wondered, you know, again, if we look forward to the next few years, so like that we're speaking just after Christmas in 2016, when the Amazon Alexa has gone nuts, you know, which to me means a massive shift in audiobooks, for example. Like my husband's just listening to audio on Alexa all the time, and, you know, stuff like that. So what do you see coming in the next couple of years, short term, for publishing, the publishing industry, and what indies should be looking out for in the next couple of years?
I do think audiobooks are going to be really important. I also think, oddly enough, beautiful paper books, because what people want, the books to everybody have always been somewhat disposable. I mean, you know, you trade them into used bookstores, you do all that other stuff, but then you have what the romance writers call keepers. The books that you absolutely love. And if you're an indie, try to do as many of your books as possible in a beautiful hardcover edition, so that the people who want the keeper volume are going to be able to keep it. The other thing is, I don't know quite how to say this, but I think it's going to become more and more important to have your network, your tribe, your group, because people love to rally. Musicians call them their fan base, and you have that whole range of fan bases. You know, you had the people who followed the Grateful Dead all over the United States whenever they did concert to concert. And then you had the people who would see the concert when it was in town, if they could afford it. They were all fans, but there's that spectrum of fandom. And writers have that. We just never had the opportunity to cultivate it. And now we do. And you know, you can spend too much time cultivating it, but you do have to be aware that it exists and be appreciative of it and not be dismissive of either end of the spectrum. There are people who are willing to give you thousands and thousands of dollars for a particular item. And then there are people who can't afford to buy anything. And they still love you, and they're going to go out there and they're going to be your best advertisement because they are going to proselytize your stuff to other people. And so you need to have that whole range when you're thinking about your career. You need to think about the people who can't afford it, but by gum, they're the people who are going to tell their friends, buy this book or save up and buy a copy to give to friends. And then there are the people who want the beautiful hardcover edition with the slipcase and the, you know, the LP in the middle of it, because, you know, you can have some rock star write something for you and all of that cool stuff.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you on that print, the renaissance of beautiful print. And yeah, I think it's really incredible how that's happening. And I'm looking at hardbacks and beautiful stuff for this year as well. So yeah, good, excellent. I'm glad I'm going in the right direction. And I would just mention on the marketing, you have a book called Discoverability, which is all about that kind of, it's more than marketing, but I want people to check that out too, because what I love about you and Dean is you're not just write all the books and they will come. You also have a lot of techniques for marketing, but too late to go into that now. So let's just finish.
Well, it's on my website, which is free. Mm. It's just out of order because I write out of order. So, you know, you're not going to get it edited and cleaned up. But you'll at least get it.
Yes, no, I think everyone should buy it, actually. Exactly. So tell people where they can find your books and everything you do online.
Okay, my books are available in all of the various stores. You can also find information about me at chriswrites.com, which is K-R-I-S, writes, W-R-I-T-E-S.com. And, you know, there are places, WMG Publishing publishes a lot of my work, not all of my work. And that's WMGpublishing.com. And you can order books directly from them if you want to. I have a hunch that'll be more important when we start doing some of these more limited editions, that we're starting to branch into really beautiful books and stuff. And those are harder to sell, like on Amazon and stuff, not because Amazon won't sell them, but because when you're doing a limited edition, if you run out, you run out. And that takes a different kind of marketing. So you can find me pretty much anywhere.
Yeah, fantastic. Thanks so much for your time, Chris. That was great.
Thank you, Joanna. I really appreciate it.
I hope you enjoyed the interview with Chris, and definitely check out her business blog at chriswrites.com and also her book, Closing the Deal on Your Terms, Agents, Contracts and Other Considerations. So I'll be back next week with an interview with John Lee Dumas, podcaster extraordinaire at Entrepreneur on Fire. And we'll be talking about his premium hardcover gold embossed print journal, the Mastery Journal. He also did the Freedom Journal last year. He did a massive launch. He did a $400,000 launch. And I want to pick his brains about the companies to use if you want to outsource your printing to China and then warehouse and distribute through Amazon. So really interesting discussion with John. Also, we talk about discipline and achieving what you want. So really looking forward to sharing that with you. A very useful topic at this time of year. Right. Happy creative week and bye for now. Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes and show notes available at thecreativepen.com/podcast. You can also get your free author blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at thecreativepen or find me on Facebook at thecreativepen. See you next time.